Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
There's a really great photograph from Getty, which shows the factory where they made it. And it's just, I mean, it looks like a giant Rube Goldberg, Willy Wonka, and the Poison Death Factory machine. I mean, it's just pipes all over the place. It is a very complicated undertaking. And even then, when they had that very expensive, very large, very elaborate facility, the sarin that they produced was not of a high caliber.
You're listening to War College, a weekly podcast that brings you the stories from behind the front lines. Here are your hosts, Matthew Galt and Jason Fields.
Hello and welcome to War College. I'm Matthew Galt. My co-host Jason Fields is at a birthday party for the war in Afghanistan, which turned 17 years old today and won't be joining us. Today, we're going to talk about the Russian scandal. No, not that Russia scandal, the other one. In March, Sergei Skripal and his daughter collapsed on a park bench in Salisbury, England. Authorities soon realized the pair had been poisoned by a Cold War-era nerve agent. On June 30th, two British nationals were admitted to a hospital in Amesbury, England. They had also been poisoned by the same nerve agent, and one of them subsequently died. So, who is Skripal, and how did a Soviet chemical weapon end up on British soil? Here to help us answer those questions is Adam Ronsley. Ronsley is a reporter for The Daily Beast, where he's been covering this story, and his work has also appeared in Wired, Foreign Policy, and Bellingcat. Adam, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, well, let's start off with who is Sergei, and why do we think that he's the target?
Mr. Skripal is a former GRU officer who was recruited by British intelligence, convicted of spying for the Brits by a Russian court, sent to prison, and later swapped for a cell of sleeper agents, Russian sleeper agents here in the United States, along with some other folks. And sent back to the UK, where he was living, by all accounts, a fairly standard former defector life, or actually current defector's life, pretty quiet in retirement, until one day he woke up and was poisoned by a top secret nerve agent. And the reason why we believe he was the target was because, according to the British press, the nerve agent in question, which is known as Novichok, translates to approximately newcomer in English, was smeared all over his door handle. And the British authorities have also said that Mr. Skripal's daughter had her emails hacked. So I think it's fairly well established that whoever did this was aiming to kill Mr. Skripal and maybe his daughter.
How long had he been in England?
He was swapped around 2011. And he was, I mean, he's from the reporting, and if you, you know, ask around, he was, you know, he kept his contacts up with intelligence agencies. I believe it's been reported that he had some meetings with Baltic intelligence agencies. He may or may not have had meetings with U.S. intelligence agencies. But that's, you know, that's fairly standard. If you remember the case of another defector who was not traded, but who was actually busted out of the Soviet Union by British intelligence, Oleg Gordievsky. Mr. Gordievsky has apparently, if you read his autobiography, which is a very fascinating read, when he finally made it back to the UK after he'd been arrested and sort of under house arrest, you know, he did the circuit. He met with various other intelligence agencies. They like to get to know you, you know, just various profiling sort of information, what's it like to work in the GRU, that kind of thing. But, you know, he'd been in prison for a real long time. He'd been in prison for, I believe he was first arrested in 2003, around about then, and convicted. And he'd been in jail for a few years by the time he was sprung out. So it's not like he was very current, or that he could have offered, you know, obviously the flavor of the month is the GRU because of the DNC hacking. But, you know, Skripal is in his 60s. He there's no sign that he had any sort of hacking knowledge or skills. The rise of the internet and nation state cyber espionage sort of happened while he was in prison. So it's unlikely that he would have been a really super great source on that kind of stuff. But, you know, he kept one foot in, did a little bit of consulting, not much more than that, though. Like apparently like tank video games, which is a man after my own heart. I like those too.
Stuff like World of Tanks.
Yes. I don't know if that was his game, but that's mine.
I think it's a lot of people's game. Well, all of my friends that like tank video games love that one. But I digress. So he wasn't, okay, let me, I've got a few questions. He wasn't the only person released as part of this prisoner swap.
No.
How are the other people faring?
Yeah, so, you know, a handful of other folks were released. The ones, well, Igor Sutyagin was one of the guys released to the UK. He got a job at the Royal United Services Institute, and he had a fairly public profile, less so these days for probably obvious reasons. But I think what you're getting at here is the core of the question, which is, you know, why Skripal, which is what, if you talk to former CIA folks, people are still wondering, what was the point of this? If Vladimir Putin had wanted Sergei Skripal dead, he had ample opportunity for years while he was rotting in a prison somewhere in Central Russia. And it's doubtful, you know, if he had wanted to kill him in prison, you know, we already know Mr. Magnitsky, another foe of Vladimir Putin, was killed in prison. And but for the efforts of his lawyer, that would have sort of passed unnoticed in the West. And it's, you know, you have to wonder if Sergei Skripal had been killed in prison, would we be talking about him today? Would he be the cause celebre he is since he's been poisoned? No, I don't think so. So it doesn't seem personal. Like, you know, the last poisoning that we're aware of that the Russians did was Alexander Litvinenko, who was a former FSB officer, who was a very strident critic of Vladimir Putin, defected to the UK, became an MI6 officer, or excuse me, became an MI6 asset, was recruited by one Christopher Steele and handled by Christopher Steele, famous for the Steele dossier. And Litvinenko just, you know, really, really from exile lit into Putin and was a giant thorn in his side and was criticizing him, was accusing him of complicity in, you know, the famous apartment bombings. So it's fairly easy to divine a personal motive in the Litvinenko case where he was poisoned with polonium. Skripal, when he was arrested, by all accounts, by Russian media accounts, confessed immediately. And assisted in, at least according to the Russians, the British government has obviously not confirmed this, but Skripal, according to the Russians, assisted Russian intelligence services in identifying his handler, Pablo Miller, who we know was a diplomat for Her Majesty's Foreign Service, and whom the Russians accused of recruiting Skripal. So, you know, he was a very pliant prisoner, did not resist, cooperated in the investigation, served his time and left, you know, and when he was finally exiled, did not become a huge, you know, dissident bomb thrower accusing Vladimir Putin of things, which leaves us with the question, why? There's a lot of speculation. You have to stipulate from the beginning that no one knows. But, you know, one of the speculations I've heard from folks who are a little bit more informed is that, you know, if you want people to shut up, if you are worried about foreign intelligence penetrations of your own service, what CIA folks will tell you is that even within the norms of espionage, where certain types of bad behaviors are expected, this was shocking. The idea that you would go after someone who had been traded, even for the Russians, was shocking to some intelligence folks. And if you look at the way the Skripals were living, both him and his daughter, they were not taking precautions as though they felt that they were in danger. Yulia Skripal had a Facebook account. She was working at a Russian company. She was living in Russia. She was visiting her father. It would not have been very hard at all for the Russian intelligence officials to follow her trail of, you know, digital evidence to her father. You know, from all accounts, while he wasn't living out loud, he wasn't exactly living, you know, underground under heavy duties of protection or something like that. So one theory, keeping in mind just speculation, is that he just happened to be low-hanging fruit, that he was not, you know, it's evident in the lack of security surrounding him and the relatively open way that his daughter was living and visiting him, that there was a belief that he was not targeted and that he did not feel particularly under threat. And if you talk to CIA people again, they will tell you that this is one of the interesting challenges of spy work in modern life, is that, you know, you have to resettle if you have a defector, if you have someone who comes over, you don't just have to resettle them. If you manage to get their kids or their family out, you got to resettle them. And what's the first thing that every kid does? You know, you give them a fake passport, you give them a name. What's the first thing that every kid will do? Sign up for a Facebook account. Which is a huge threat if you're trying to keep someone. You know, what happens if they friend someone they used to know? What happens if you're able to discover them from a pattern of likes or some other sort of information they're hemorrhaging out onto social media? But yeah, we have no idea what the operational point of this operation was.
Well, and the nerve agent used is such a strange choice.
It is the unicorn of chemical weapons. You know, if you'd asked people just a month before all this happened what a Novichok was, the only people who would answer you are a handful of chemical weapons history dorks. But Novichoks are descended from VX, which is another nerve agent. And the gist of their history is that in the latter years of the Cold War, the Soviet Union wanted to develop a more powerful chemical weapon in secret, and they gathered a handful of scientists, and they worked in secret at a top secret lab while, coincidentally, the Soviet Foreign Ministry was in the process of negotiating what would become the Chemical Weapons Convention. And the oft-stated factoid about it is that it's supposed to be 10 times more powerful than VX. I think an important thing to keep in mind when we're revisiting the history of Novichoks is that these were not designed as intelligence assassin weapons, right? These were designed for use on the battlefield. So this was not them making small, tiny little bits of research quantity kind of stuff with the hopes of one day using them in an assassination. The goal of the Novichok development in the latter 1980s was to develop a battlefield weapon. And the reason why we, the public, know about them, as opposed to them, the intelligence community, is a guy named Vil Mirzyanov, who was a scientist who worked on the Novichok program in secret. And towards the late 1980s, the whole era of glasnost, perestroika, that kind of thing, was starting to sort of catch on among a lot of Soviets. And he found the concept of chemical weapons morally repugnant. And he did not like what he was doing. And as the Soviet Union fell apart and eventually died, he became more and more public about what he had done. He wrote an article and worked with a reporter from the Baltimore Sun to reveal what had gone on. He did a short stint in jail in Russia. And then eventually he came to the United States. He now lives in Princeton, New Jersey. I was able to find him. He lives openly. If you ask him whether he's afraid for his own security, he doesn't basically tell you he does not give a crap. And he's happy to talk basically to whomever. He'll talk to two guys in a phone booth about what he did. He published a book in 2008. What I can tell you is that his book was very controversial, and the U.S. intelligence community disapproved of it quite a bit, because the book he released in 2008 contains formulas for the Novichoks. And that was particularly controversial. The FBI, CIA, intelligence community specifically asked him, as I've been told, not to include those He's a, as folks of a certain age tend to be, he's very stubborn. And what he'll say is, this isn't the Soviet Union. This isn't your information. This is my information. He's a scientist. And, you know, scientists are very, very big on open information sometimes. And so he said, this is my information to publish. And so he published them. And that was very controversial because one of the things that you'll notice is that the word Novichok or any of the various permutations of it, there's different sort of versions of it, does not appear in the Chemical Weapons Convention. And that was, if you go back to some of the congressional debates over it, even Mr. Mizyanov, or I guess I should say Dr. Mizyanov, himself briefly issued some sort of concerns about it. It is not included in the Chemical Weapons Convention on the schedule of proscribed weapons. And there's a variety of reasons. There's a variety of reasons people will tell you. One, which I tend to hear the most, which I find the most convincing, is that, and this has come up at the OPCW in subsequent technical meetings, is that the U.S. did not want to basically, you know, the old chemical weapons, sarin, VX, those kinds of things, the recipes for those and the formulas had been known for a long time. The genie was out of the bottle. And so there is no real proliferation risk to listing the chemicals on a public schedule as part of a international treaty to say these are forbidden. Novichok's formulas at that time, it was not until 2008, were not public. And the argument is that the U.S. government did not want other people to have access to that formula in the event that nations, you have to remember in the 1990s, the Soviet Union had fell. And so the big threats that people worried about were terrorists and WMD, not terribly different from today, but very similar. The belief was that let's just not mention this because we don't want Iran or Syria or North Korea or whoever to figure out how to make these things. And then we've got a new basket of proliferation problems on our hands. Another argument, which is not necessarily in tension with the proliferation argument, is that it was essentially a matter of diplomatic expediency, is that putting them on the schedule would require Russia in some way to be candid about them, certainly for the United States to be candid about what it knew before Mr. Mirzianov's book was published, which is an interesting story, which has only sort of been reported on. They did not essentially want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Is that we don't want to make the perfect the enemy of the good. Let's worry about these chemical weapons, which are known, which are widely, you know, included in a bunch of different arsenals. Let's not blow the whole thing up over a super duper mystery chemical weapon that exists, as far as we know, only in one country's stockpiles.
How did they figure out that that's what it was?
That is a good question. And I may botch some of the technical aspects of this, but I've talked to OPCW scientists and chemical weapons folks. It is reported, and I have reason to believe that the reporting is accurate, that the CIA covertly acquired a sample of Novichok sometime after the fall of the Soviet Union. Mr. Mirzianov published his formulas in 2008. I don't know how accurate those formulas are, how accurate his memory is. So you can, you know, synthesize based on a sort of a spectral footprint, I guess is the term. Again, I'm not a scientist, so chemist, please feel free to correct me on my terminology. But essentially, based on what's known and what I've been told by OPCW, former OPCW people, I should say, is that, you know, the Russians will try and use this as sort of some sort of dark, sinister conspiracy. But it's my understanding that a lot of countries would have tried to synthesize Novichok based on public information, maybe perhaps based on private information, because that is essentially prudent chemical defense, is when you hear of a possible threat that could be used, you try and figure out what it is and you try and come up with a chemical footprint for it. So that in the event it turns up, you can be able to identify it, you can be able to mitigate it, whatnot. And that a number of countries who invest heavily in chemical defense, case in point, the United States, the United Kingdom, would have tried to synthesize this in research quantities in order to figure out how to defend against it, which is not, you know, anything sinister. Is that, you know, this is the problem with WMD. This is a problem. You see this a lot in biological weapons. Is, yes, there's a chemical weapons convention. Yes, there is a biological weapons convention. Yes, the United States has sworn off using chemical and biological weapons. But in the case of biological weapons, you know, we had small research quantities of anthrax that we used. You may remember them because if you at least buy the FBI's version of the story, somebody stole them from Fort Detrick, and used them after the 9/11 attacks and poisoned a few people, killed a few people. That is not against the treaty because you're allowed to have small research quantities for defense. In the case of the U.S., we were trying to make an anthrax vaccine, and we were using aerosolized anthrax and, you know, putting it on lab rats and whatnot and trying to figure out, you know, what the best way to make a vaccine is. So when the Brits were able to come out and say this was a Novichok, that was likely based on chemical defense research that they had done prior to that, whether they had culled that from open sources, whether they had culled that from some covert acquisition. That's a very good story, which no one has fully been able to report out, although there have been, I think it was Spiegel, there was a German newspaper that did report that the CIA had been able to acquire a sample of Novichok from Russia. But yeah, the fun thing is someone tweeted this, you know, I realized, that's actually true. Try and get a public official to say Novichok. It's very difficult, probably because the understanding, and at least my rudimentary understanding is that the classification levels on that kind of stuff, people very, you can see it said, I think there's a State Department briefing where they say Novichok, but anybody further down the line than that, people are very hesitant to say the Novichok word. I think a lot of what we know and how we know it is still sort of shrouded in mystery, because even though, the Russians were not coming clean on that, they still haven't come clean. They do not admit having it.
That leads me to my next question, and we'll go down briefly a conspiratorial path here. Britain seems very confident that Russia did this.
Yes.
Do we have any idea how they know that, or why they suspect that? Obviously it's a Soviet era, chemical that came from them. But like, as you said, you look at these anthrax attacks, research chemicals do get out and are used improperly by the people that were researching on them. How do we know that something like that didn't occur here because of the target? Can you speak to that?
So the Brits have come out and said, this is definitely Novichok. I think their public case is attribution based on the exquisite covert origins of the Novichok. There's some reporting that the Five Eyes have had signals intelligence coverage on one of the labs involved in it. I think that's probably a very good bet. But publicly, what they will say is this was the Russians, and it was the Russians because of the nature of the target, and because Novichok is essentially, this has never surfaced publicly before. You get some of this conspiracy stuff from the Syria side, which I'm pretty familiar with. Is that the shorthand for it is kitchen sarin, and there's this mythical belief that it is possible to brew up sarin in your kitchen, which is insane, essentially. The only non-governmental organization that we know of in history that has produced a nerve agent is the Aum Shinrikyo cult in Japan. And I don't know, there's a really great photograph from Getty which shows the factory where they made it. And it's just, it looks like a giant Rube Goldberg, Willy Wonka and the Poison Death Factory machine. It's just pipes all over the place. It is a very complicated undertaking. And even then, when they had that very expensive, very large, very elaborate facility, the sarin that they produced was not of a high caliber. And the British officials say that, the purity and the quality of the Novichok involved in that case was, as I said, exquisite. These are not, these are not things that are easily brewed up on all by your lonesome.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
All right, let's flash forward to the recent poisoning. What's going on here? This is in Amesbury. How far away is this from where the first poisoning happened?
The people involved visited Amesbury. The two people poisoned. So what happened was two people show up. This is a couple weeks ago. And like the Skripal poisonings, when the Skripals were first found, the initial reporting was fentanyl poisoning. They thought it was some sort of opioid thing. And here again, when Charlie Rowley and Dawn Sturgis were discovered, again, they suspected fentanyl poisoning. Mr. Rowley is a former heroin addict. Ms. Sturgis is a former alcoholic, and that's not to shame them in any way. But that is merely to explain why. That was the initial sort of suspicion. Ms. Sturgis had been living in a homeless shelter, and Mr. Rowley was her boyfriend. And then it emerged that they, British authorities said they had been poisoned with Novichok. And the question was, how are, you know, this completely innocent couple, one of whom is homeless, living in a homeless shelter, how are they mixed up in this? They had visited, the public health authorities released a list of five places they had been. The shelter where Ms. Sturgis was living was not very far from the town square where the Skripals were found. You know, it's just a few blocks. I've mapped it. They went to a church picnic, I think. They went to a friend's place in Amesbury, which is just a couple miles up the road from Salisbury. And when, I think it was, I believe, the second or third day, it might have been July 5th, the Metropolitan Police came out and said that they believed that the couple were not deliberately targeted, excuse me. And everything that was coming out of the British government at that point was radiating, we do not think this is a new incident. And what started to trickle out was that fellow residents of the homeless shelter where Ms. Sturgis lived suspected that it might have been a cigarette butt that she'd picked up. The British media was reporting that Mr. Rowley was a skip diver, to like the little trash bins. And then he often salvaged stuff from the trash. And we didn't know what it was, but at a certain point, it started to become obvious because, the chemical that Novichoks are derived from, VX, it's what's, again, these were designed for battlefield use, and VX is non-persistent. And what that means is you use it on the battlefield against enemy troops. They die a horrible, horrible death. And then not terribly long after, it is possible to walk through that area and live to tell the tale. And this is what you see in Syria where, you know, and again, this gets into the conspiracy stuff, is like, oh, well, how are these, you know, Syrian chemical weapons victims able to be picked up by first responders? Well, because in the case of Syria, sarin is a non-persistent chemical weapon. You know, but it makes battlefield sense that if you want to claim that territory, if you want to move through that territory, it would be nice if you could do that and live to tell the tale. And so VX is non-persistent. And so the question was, is, you know, if this is, you know, if you mapped where public health authorities said the couple were versus the last day of the poisoning of Mr. Skripal and his daughter, there was proximity, but there was no direct overlap. And the area where, you know, the only area where we saw an incidental poisoning was at the house. There was a policeman who was sickened on the occasion when Mr. Skripal and his daughter were poisoned. He was poisoned at the house. The largest concentration of Novichok was found on the doorknob. It's believed that they smeared it on the doorknob. And so, you know, the agent is non-persistent. You know, how on earth, if it had come from the Skripals, and, you know, if it was a tissue, if it was a handkerchief, if it was something, it just didn't make sense that they could have been poisoned by something that came from the Skripals. So right away, I think just about every reporter on this, their spidey sense was tingling and saying, this is not, whatever this is from came from the attackers. And subsequently, we have very recently figured out that that is most likely the case. Matthew Rowley, who is the brother of Charlie Rowley, has come out and said that his brother, and this is another one of the intriguing things, is that Ms. Sturgis became sick before Mr. Rowley. It was about a four-hour gap. He saw her off in an ambulance, was taking a shower, and that's when he became symptomatic. But his brother said that the reporting differs whether or not his recollection is perfect, whether or not it was a perfume bottle or a cologne bottle. But that is, and the Metropolitan Police will only say a quote unquote small bottle. So it sounds as though they were, you know, they just had a string of rotten luck, and that in the course of looking around something or another, they found a bottle which had been used to carry Novichok, which would explain the larger quantity, why they could be, you know, and it was apparently contained, you know, in a bottle, it would have a cap. You know, that would explain how they came to be poisoned. It was mostly, and this is, it's fascinating because, you know, we, the public thus far, have no trace of who the attackers are other than the Novichok sprayed on the door handle. This would be the first evidence that we've seen aside from that door handle. From the attackers. The unfortunate part, you know, if you talk to chemists, they say, you know, you're unlikely to recover fingerprints because if you found fingerprints, you'd find a body not terribly far. It would have made sense for them to carry that in gloves. But unfortunately, Ms. Sturgis passed away. I believe Mr. Rowley is expected to make a recovery. It's a hard fight. And that's, you know, one of the things that I try to ram home to people is that we know of one person besides the Skripals, besides this couple, we know of only one person who has been poisoned by a Novichok, and that was a scientist who worked with Vilmar Zianov and poisoned accidentally. And there's a leak, and he lived for an agonizing 5 years. Now, granted, this was Soviet medical care. This was 1980s medical care, but it's consistent with, we know, you know, there are chemical weapons survivors. A lot of them are in Iran because of the Iran-Iraq war. They were poisoned by Saddam Hussein's chemical weapons. A lot of them are formerly from Syria. And it's a hard slog. And they've done studies that show people who have been poisoned by nerve agents, the rates of post-traumatic stress. It is, you know, living is just the beginning of the journey, or beginning of the journey, is that they are in for a long, hard road to recovery, which is what makes this so particularly brutal and heinous.
All right, let's circle back around to Pablo Miller. What can you tell me about him?
So Pablo Miller is accused, and I emphasize accused because there is no independent confirmation of this, accused by the Russian intelligence services of not being a diplomat for Her Majesty's Foreign Service, but being an undercover MI6 officer. And initially, I think the Daily Beast is one of three news outlets I'm aware of that has actually seen. He had a LinkedIn profile that was deleted very quickly afterwards, because once Mr. Skripal's name came out very quickly, if you start flipping through the news, you see he is connected to a British diplomat by the name of Pablo Miller in the Russian press. So the, you know, I'll tell you what, I'll begin with the story of recruitment. So what we know from the Russian, or at least what the Russians have revealed, is that Mr. Skripal was working for the GRU and was recruited in 1995 by British intelligence. The most detailed information about his recruitment report comes from a report in The Times, British newspaper. That says he was recruited as part of a joint joint UK Spanish operation. Is that he was posted to the embassy in Madrid. The Spanish ID'd him, and a unnamed in the Times British intelligence officer began to court him under the pretext of setting up a joint wine export business. He is believed to have been betrayed sometime between 2000 and 2003 by a former Spanish intelligence officer who was convicted of espionage, Roberto Flores Garcia. And he worked for Spain's Center for National Intelligence. He was convicted, I believe, in 2010. He is accused of having passed information to a Russian intelligence officer at the embassy in Madrid between 2000 and 2003. And in the process of doing that, he is believed to have betrayed Mr. Skripal, which lines up with when Mr. Skripal was arrested. The first time we hear Pablo Miller connected with espionage in the press is 2000. And in that case, it's in Estonia, which is a known hotbed of Russian espionage and U.S. counterintelligence and U.K. counterintelligence work against Russians. Mr. Miller, if you go back through British government records, had been in the British Army. He was a member of the 4th Royal Tank Regiment. I believe he was also a member of the Royal Green Jackets. And around about 1990, he joins the Foreign Service. He was posted initially to Nigeria. Abuja was one of his first postings. In 1995, when Mr. Skripal was alleged to have been recruited, British government records show Mr. Miller was posted to the Foreign Commonwealth Office in London. Shortly thereafter, I believe his next posting was to Tallinn, Estonia. And around about 2000, shortly before, Mr. Putin loves his timing, shortly before a meeting between then Prime Minister Tony Blair and Vladimir Putin, the Russians announced the arrest of a former FSB officer by the name of Valery Ojame. I'm probably butchering that name, I'll just say. And they claim that he had been recruited by a Mr. Pablo Miller, who they said, quote unquote, was the head of British intelligence in Tallinn. They accused him of being jointly, again, it was another case where the Russians were saying he was jointly run by British intelligence and the domestic spy service of the Estonians. He's accused of having passed to British British intelligence information about Russian signals intelligence. And there's actually, they name the quaint little bed and breakfast. It's still there. If you want to go there, you can go see where a former Russian FSB officer was allegedly recruited and had meetings with his handlers. But so that he surfaces in that, and it sort of spoils the atmosphere for the meeting between Putin and Tony Blair. I believe it happened either shortly before or shortly after. My memory is a little bit fuzzy. But it was a controversial meeting because Blair was the first big Western leader to meet with Putin. This was after he had just sort of taken over for Boris Yeltsin. And, you know, he's trying to reach out and, you know, be his sort of entree to the Western world. And this is how he gets repaid. His name in connection with Sergei Skripal doesn't surface until years later during the arrest of, I'm going to butcher the name again, but I think it's Vyacheslav Zarko. He's a Russian tax inspector. And he gets arrested. It's 2007 that Zarko is arrested. And he, in the course of reporting on him, Russian media says that Mr. Pablo Miller had also been identified by Sergei Skripal as his handler when he was, running him as an agent. And then he sort of goes to ground, and we don't hear from him. He gets put up. The Queen was kind enough to say that, or she put him in the birthday honors list for service to British foreign policy. He gets, I think it's an OBE he got, or to the British Empire. So, there he goes quiet. And since then, after the Skripal poisoning, and the interesting thing is that at least if you look at the, they didn't give an address, but they gave a town where Mr. Miller was living. He lived not very far from Sergei Skripal at the time of Skripal's poisoning. And so he lives a very quiet life up until that point. I believe he had a posting in Colombia and a posting in Poland after Estonia, after all the late unpleasantness with the Russian intelligence accusations. He had a LinkedIn. I believe it was the day after the Skripal poisoning, that LinkedIn disappears, and we have not heard hide or hair of him since. Part of that is what I can say, because I've been told by several people, is that they used to be called a D notice, defense notice. I believe it's called a DSMA notice now. It's essentially a British government official censorship request saying, please do not report him, Mr. Miller. I wouldn't read necessarily too much into that. They might just, that is not to be taken as, de facto confirmation of his status as an MI6 officer. It could just be that, they don't want anybody else reporting on this guy. And, he's connected to a guy who's already been poisoned, so they're concerned for his safety. But for what it's worth, there is a official censorship request related to Mr. Miller, but that does not apply to Americans. Ha ha. But yeah, so and there's also, the Telegraph had a I'll just come out and say the Telegraph had a bad story. And they came out and said that Pablo Miller had worked for Orbis, which is Christopher Steele's firm, and that he had some connection to the Steele dossier. I can't say whether or not he had any connection to the Steele dossier, but I can say we're one of three outlets that has screenshots and actually viewed his, Daily Beast, CNN, I believe, Medusa. There's nothing, no mention of Orbis in that whatsoever. I believe, I have to double check on this, but I believe the Telegraph claimed that, you know, he had mentioned that he worked for Orbis. There is no mention of Orbis in his LinkedIn whatsoever. And a lot of people have come out since that report and said, no, that is not correct. I see absolutely no evidence, which, you know, it would have been nice for us reporters because it would have given us a logical motive for the poisoning. But at least as far as the evidence I have seen, you know, I can't prove a negative, but there's no evidence I've seen. And I've probably done a lot more reporting on Pablo Miller than a lot of people that he has any connection whatsoever to the Steele dossier. There's no public evidence of that whatsoever yet.
So how is the Kremlin reacting to all of this? You know, obviously they've denied it, but I also see that people in Russia are selling T-shirts and beer that's been branded with the nerve agent.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're doing their usual trolley stuff, which is, you know, they spread conspiracies and the British did it. No, anybody. They link it together with the Syria chemical weapons stuff because they're always trying to sort of cape for the Assad regime and its use of chemical weapons. And the OPCW, which has been invited by the British government to, verify and investigate their findings, is sort of a bugbear for the Russians because the OPCW keeps finding out and proving that their clients, the Assad regime, gas civilians, so they're not terribly pleased about that. But, you know, it's the usual mixture of conspiracy, fear, uncertainty, doubt, you know, that kind of thing. I think, you know, one thing on the connection between, you know, Syria and this, one thing that I see a lot of people in the non-proliferation world and somewhat in the .gov world really concerned about is, you know, just take a look back 10 years ago. You know, the only time we were talking about chemical weapons was about how they weren't in Iraq. And now we've had multiple chemical weapons uses in Syria. We've had the poisoning in Salisbury and the sort of secondary poisoning in Amesbury. And we've had VX used against Kim Jong-un's half-brother. People are legitimately worried that the norm against chemical weapons use is starting to erode. And that's what makes this more than just, you know, a normal sort of assassination, is that it used to be, you know, we had these treaties. It just does not seem as though people, the taboo is eroding, if only slightly. And I think that's very worrisome.
Well, only slightly when it comes to chemical weapons, that's a big deal.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I say that only because, you know, I don't expect the Russian army to start kitting up with mop suits and using it again. But, you know, we've spent years building up, people talk about eroding norms. We spent years investing diplomacy. We've spent years investing a lot trying to make these a taboo weapon, and they're no longer taboo. And, you know, the worst part is that there's a really good piece on War on the Rocks is that they work. If you're evil enough to use them against civilians, you know, Assad has shown that, you know, if you don't care about humanity or basic norms of human behavior, you can make these things work to your own ends. And that is not a great example to be setting for future insurgencies and for future counterinsurgencies. I think there's a real concern that this may be the beginning of something rather than the end of it.
Adam Ronsley, I think that is a prophetic and terrifying place to end the discussion, which is like how we like to do here on War College. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Where can people follow your work?
I am at thedailybeast.com. Thanks.
That's it for this week. Thank you, as always, for listening. War College is me, Matthew Galt, and Jason Fields. You can follow the show on Twitter at @war_college or check out our website at warcollegepodcast.com, where those long-awaited transcripts are finally starting to show up. If you like the show, please leave us a review on iTunes. It helps other people find the show, and If we like it, Jason just may read it on the air. We'll see you next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.